Good evening, everybody. Wonderful to see you. My name is David Toombs. I'm the Howard Patterson Chair of Theology and Public Issues here at the University of Otago. It's my pleasure this evening to introduce our distinguished speaker, Reverend Dr. Doug Gay from the University of Glasgow. Doug teaches practical theology in Glasgow, but he's also a writer. He's very involved in the church, and he's principal of Trinity College, the Theological Training College of the Church of Scotland. We're absolutely delighted that he's had an opportunity to come and visit us here in New Zealand as the Stuart Residence Hall Council Distinguished Visitor for this year. He's been hard at work with events at Knox Church, also meeting some of our postgraduate theology students, lecturing in the Centre for Irish and Scottish Studies, and this evening we have an opportunity to hear him address us towards an ecumenical political theology, charisms, Catholic, Reformed and Anabaptist. Please welcome Doug Gay.
I want to express my gratitude to CTPI for their generous invitation in partnership with the School of Scottish and Irish Studies, and to offer particular thanks to the Stuart Residence Halls Council for their generous support of my visit. It's been a very great pleasure to spend time here in Dunedin and at the University of Otago. I've experienced the most warm and generous of welcomes from colleagues, from church folk, and not least from Jamie and the team at Arana, so thank you. In the lecture today, I want to reflect on the characteristics of an ecumenical political theology by considering the charisms which can be brought to it from different theological traditions. The concept of a charism, in the sense I'm using it, is itself borrowed from Roman Catholic tradition, and in particular from ways of characterizing the particular mission, orientation, and values of the various religious orders. To use this term is to introduce from the outset a focus on gratitude to God, the giver of all good things, and on an expectant ecumenism, which is open to recognize how divine grace is mediated to us through religious and ecclesial traditions other than our own. I'm aware that such a reflection could float away from the focus on practice, which is integral to my own discipline of practical theology, and from the engagement with public issues, which is the particular charism of CTPI. And to avoid that, I will ground the reflections tonight in relation to economic questions. I could have opted for questions of nationalism and state formation, but I thought I would vary the diet for those who came to last night's lecture. On the flight over from Scotland, struggling as always to get my 6'4" frame to sleep in economy, I enjoyed binging on in-flight movies, among which was the 2015 movie directed by Adam McKay, The Big Short. Has anyone seen that movie? Well, I recommend it. It's based on Michael Lewis's best-selling 2010 book of the same name, and it begins with the invention of mortgage securities in the 1970s, but its particular focus is the subprime mortgage crisis, which triggered the financial collapse of 2007 to 2009. So I recommend the movie. In fact, as an aside, I've noticed that an increasing number of churches seem to be having movie nights or small groups which gather to watch films and discuss them, and sometimes as a form of Christian education and sometimes with a more missional intent. In my experience, many of them tend to watch movies like Babette's Feast, which is a great movie. But I hope some of them might watch a movie like The Big Short or perhaps Spotlight, which I also saw on the way over. Perhaps CTPI should do some movie nights, political theology with added popcorn. The current Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, had a background in the oil industry, and as Bishop of Durham had been involved with the 2012 Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards. He was interviewed by the UK's Guardian newspaper in 2013 between his election and installation as Archbishop. Welby reaches for a letter from the economist John Maynard Keynes to Virginia Woolf. The bishop tries to recite the quote from memory. "We are the lucky generation. We have inherited the benefits of our father's faith, but don't have the moral obligations. The next generation will be lost in their lust like dogs. We have destroyed Christianity. They will reap the cost of that." In other words, Welby suggests we're living off and running down the cultural capital of Christianity. Challenged by the journalist on the failure of Christians in the city, Welby responded, "Keynes saw the fallibility of human beings, but not clearly enough. He thought we could get to the point where we could be satisfied with enough. It's clear that in this place, the City of London, this is not going to happen. The opportunity to make enormous sums of money is enormously corrupting." Using a similar historical lens to The Big Short, I want to begin by looking back to the economic crisis of 2007-2009, and also to my membership between 2010 and 2012 of a Church of Scotland commission established in response to this crisis to reflect on the purposes of economic activity. I am one of what we call in the UK Thatcher's children. I came of age politically from 1979 as Margaret Thatcher and then Ronald Reagan came to power. And the blunt ultimatum offered then was often summarised as "Tina, there is no alternative." For my generation, Thatcherism and Reaganomics offered a perverse catechism into our own unfitness to take part in economic debates. Back then, people spoke of the high priests of monetarism, Milton Friedman chief among them. Did you have someone here called Roger Douglas who was of that ilk? The resort to sacral categories, high priests of monetarism, to identify these theorists functioned rhetorically to associate them with an economic orthodoxy which was both rigid and arcane, and to promote them to a vicarious role on behalf of the rest of us. We were mere economic and political laity, a dull catechumenate whose ignorance of how to expound M1, M2 and M3 was proof of our unfitness to draw near. They, on our behalf, would undertake the elaborate preparation of the sacrifices, and our role looking back was to be the sacrifices. The famous maxim of the Clinton campaign, "The economy is stupid," stressed the strategic importance of the state of the economy to the electorate. It did not overcome the continuing assumption that electorates were too stupid to understand the economy. And something of the pathos of that exclusion was movingly evoked in Bruce Springsteen's classic song, "The River." "Got a job working construction with the Johnstown Company, but lately there ain't been much work on account of the economy." The tone of that exclusion moved from baldly patronising to nakedly contemptuous in the era of the Big Bang. The post-1986 combination of computerisation and deregulation which supercharged the operations of the financial markets. The American author Tom Wolfe named the moment in 1987, displacing the metaphor of high priest with his new and chilling phrase, "the masters of the universe." The focus had moved from market economists being intellectually and theoretically unchallengeable to market makers being practically and politically unchallengeable. There were some theological challenges around this time. One famous example, the US Catholic Bishop's 1986 pastoral letter, "Economic Justice for All," which evoked highly critical responses from people such as Michael Novak. Shielded by the apparently impenetrable orthodoxies of monetarism, Keith Joseph and Margaret Thatcher gave the UK public couthy lectures on not living beyond their means and balancing the books. An increasingly confident neoliberalism emphasised the primary moral duty to generate wealth, arguing that this would be best enabled by minimal regulation and suggesting that the benefits would trickle down to all sections of society. In the face of this discourse, theologians and church leaders in the 1980s were inspired by the insights of liberation theology to argue for God's bias to the poor, and to protest in documents like the Church of England's landmark 1985 report, "Faith in the City," against the effects of monetarist policies on Britain's poorest communities. The Church of Scotland followed this with its 1988 report, "Just Sharing," produced with that other CTPI back in Edinburgh, which was symbolically presented to Margaret Thatcher after her address to its General Assembly, the Sermon on the Mound, if you know of that, in that same year. Looking back on the 1980s, however, two other events now seem to have thrown the Church's witness in economic affairs off balance. The first was a key symbolic moment in terms of economic globalisation, 27th of October 1986. the day referred to as the Big Bang, when the London Stock Exchange changed both its mode of trading and its trading rules. Now, that describes a combination of factors. There was a systemic shift to new electronic screen-based technologies, which allowed for real-time computerized trading of stocks and shares on a global scale. And this was combined with a deregulation of trading conditions, which opened the markets and market making to a much wider range of participants. In effect, almost anyone with access to a PC and an internet connection. While those were the immediate circumstances of the Big Bang, this symbolic moment highlights two themes, technological change and market deregulation, which were both interdependent and which drove a massive acceleration and expansion of global financial markets. The increased computerization of markets also contributed to a process of virtualization and abstraction or liquefaction of capital, which circulated ever more quickly across expanding global networks. The other very different event which impacted the Church's social witness was the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the end of the communist bloc within Eastern Europe. While Western critiques of communism had been long-standing, the breakup of Eastern Europe was hailed as the end of history and the triumph of capitalism. In its own way, it was felt to be some kind of crisis of the left and of the traditions of social analysis and critique inspired by Marxism. The influence of liberation theology, I defer to my colleague, Professor Toombs here, which had been growing within Western institutions and churches throughout the 1970s and 1980s, never fully recovered from these events and from the influence of the Polish Pope John Paul II as actor within them and interpreter of them to the wider church and the world. In both the UK and the US, the church's social witness within the economic sphere entered what we might call a quiet period, with a sense that it had been overtaken technologically, conceptually, and ideologically by a fast-changing world. The first attempt to roll back from this came with the so-called Jubilee campaigns around the millennium, which focused on cancellation of the sovereign debt of developing countries. First as Jubilee 2000, and then from 2005 as Make Poverty History. These campaigns were successful in mobilising broad-based support with the churches as leading players within the UK and as part of an international coalition, and were seen to have had some success in influencing outcomes. Much of their momentum was subsequently absorbed into similarly structured campaigns which refocused on climate change and global warming. These campaigns were significant because the churches found their political voice within them and were confident enough to rally and unite around a clear and easily simplified agenda. The same was not true, I suggest, in relation to domestic economic policies and the workings of the international financial system. Particularly within the UK and the USA, an Anglo-American model of capitalism, heavily influenced by a neoliberal agenda, dominated the policy environment, such that even when the Blairite Labour Party or the Clinton Democrats were in power, there was little sense of political space within which to offer a radical challenge. Throughout the 90s and the noughties, a number of other trends can now be identified. Currency speculation had grown steadily from the 1970s after the abandonment of the gold standard for the dollar. The international money markets built muscle faster than Lance Armstrong, forming aggressive pelotons which could hunt in packs and take down weaker currencies. There was continuing pressure for the further deregulation of banks and financial institutions, driven by a beggar-my-neighbour policy, whereby the relaxation of regulations by the City of London meant that Wall Street had to follow suit or see huge amounts of capital flow to the more lightly regulated regimes. This led in 1999 to the suspension of the Glass-Steagall Act, which dated from 1933, which had separated the depository and the investment functions of banks within the USA. As the theologian Mark C. Taylor notes in his prescient 2004 book, Confidence Games, I'm not a huge fan of Mark C. Taylor, but I'm a great fan of this book. More significant than Gordon Gekko's maxim that greed is good was the consensus that debt was good. By 2005, bank leveraging ratios had reached the astonishing levels of 30 to 1. In this brave new world, prejudice against debt was seen as simply stupid, because the returns on highly leveraged investments were simply staggering. and, as well be noted, enormously corrupting. In the years surrounding the millennium, what David Harvey describes as strange new markets had appeared. Within the world of international finance, it was the era of the mathematicians and the game theorists. Small elites of spiv boffins designed financial instruments, derivatives, or the subsequently infamous collateralized debt obligations, which offered the alchemic promise of simultaneously extending and hedging risk. The confidence games of global financial markets became a semiotic poker in which confidence was virtually the only collateral in town. When confidence evaporated, capital evaporated. And here we enter the territory of the movie The Big Short. After 2006, waves of foreclosures in low-income areas of the US drove a giant wave of doubt about asset values, which wiped out all the major Wall Street investment banks through either change of status, forced measures, mergers, or bankruptcy. The British bank Northern Rock, facing the first run on a UK bank since the 1930s, was nationalised in February 2008. When Lehman Brothers went under on 15th September 2008, the global credit markets froze. With banks and those who insured them imploding, the only solution possible was a massive international state bailout of institutions deemed too big to fail. The neoliberal dream then was exposed as having been built on what David Harvey calls the privatization of profit and the socialization of risk. A grotesque, covert underwriting which produced what the governor of the Bank of England called systemic moral hazard. In January 2009, the New York Times journalist Andrew Ross reported a new conversation with Tom Wolfe. "The idea of masters of the universe on Wall Street just went kaput," Mr. Wolfe told me the other day, as Wall Street was digesting the news of John Tane, boss of Merrill Lynch's, ouster. "The whole order of things has changed." Naked greed had been stripped naked, the masters of the universe exposed as emperors with no clothes. In public hearings in Washington and London, it became clear that senior executives in investment banks had very limited understandings of the most complex products which were promising and delivering enhanced leverage and dizzying returns on capital. It was also clear that the retreat from the 1980s onwards by both high priests and masters into highly technical economic discourse had been a thoroughly ideological practice. Despite widespread public outrage in Europe and in the USA about the bailout of Wall Street by Main Street, overcoming the exclusion of economics from democratic discourse has proved to be a daunting task. This moment of unmasking the powers has, I suggest, been a Kairos moment for political theology, and perhaps it still is, although I'm not sure we have yet adequately responded to it. There are two key challenges still to be met. First, I think the conversations developing within particular theological and ecclesial traditions need to find better ways of attending to one another's insights and integrating them within a more ecumenical political theology. And secondly, we need more examples in which we develop a synthesis of practical theology and political theology, pushing the conversations to engage with concrete political issues and public policy challenges, arguably just what a CTPI exists to do. In a book called The Divine Economy, Stephen Long quotes R.H. Tawney's verdict that the social teachings of the church had ceased to count because the church ceased to think. If the churches are ready and willing to think, Christian theology and its ecclesial traditions can bring rich resources to the project of democratizing economic discourse and shaping a new economic imaginary. And I want now to sketch three of these, and it would be interesting in the discussion afterwards to note that there are others and what people think they might contribute. But I want to sketch three of them and to suggest that there are distinctive strengths and gifts or charisms which come from them. The first tradition is that of Roman Catholic social teaching. In his classic and prophetic 1944 study, and I highly recommend this book if you've not read it, Karl Polanyi's The Great Transformation, Karl Polanyi wrote of the dangers inherent in the running of society as an adjunct to the market. This, he said, produced a tragic inversion which, instead of economy being embedded in social relations are embedded in the economic system. Deploying the same metaphor in a theological vein some 50 years later, Stephen Long wrote in The Divine Economy, "Once the narrative phenomenon of embedding is lost, traditional moral rules about economics either become unintelligible or are transmuted to serve new interests." This is precisely what has occurred within the Christian tradition. Rules such as the just wage, the prohibition of usury, and specific forms of the admonition not to steal are no longer viable for us. All we have are the fragments of these rules, but we lack the narrative context within which they could be intelligible. For these rules to make sense, we must recover the theological narrative out of which they arise. Reflecting on the post-2008 economic crisis, we could say that bankers need tellers. And in their book Calculated Futures, Stephen Long and Nancy Fox express this well. Theology and social analysis are always already linked. When we are doing theology, we are already doing political and economic analysis. When economists are doing economics, they are also doing theology. The question is which theology is being done, not if it is being done. Everything is theological. To use God for political or economic ends is to take God's name in vain. That everything is theological then means something different from this. It means that everything which is creature, by virtue of being creature, bears some sign, some mark, some relation to the Creator, and theologians must narrate all those creatures within the divine economy. Our economic activity, our market activity, our financial dealings, these are all profoundly theological. They do not have self-evident, freestanding, scientific, technical meanings which simply speak for themselves. They are only given meaning when they have tellers, when they are placed within a bigger story of what and who they are for. And so the move is from tellers to tellos. Within my own denomination, the Church of Scotland, we were once very used to asking this kind of question. What is man's chief end? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. It's a question which is reworked in the title of a book by the brilliant American agriculturalist, novelist, poet and philosopher Wendell Berry. What are people for? Although rendered by Berry with a lovely compressed bluntness, it is of course a classic question which comes to us from Aristotle, Augustine and Aquinas, and one which is central to the evolution of Catholic social teaching. At the heart of Catholic social teaching lie the twin concepts of human dignity and the common good, concepts of the me in we and the we in me, which have been thickened and developed in 18 encyclicals since 1891. Framed within the grand narrative of creation and redemption, and confessing grace's renaturing of denatured humanity, Catholic social teaching deploys a comprehensive and a coherent vision of integral human development, parsed in terms of solidarity, subsidiarity, and sustainability. My point as a Reformed theologian in honouring this body of teaching is not to suggest that it stands alone, is infallibly correct, or that it has not been paralleled, supplemented, and challenged at many points by various strands of Protestant theology. But it is to recognise it as a profoundly important resource for all the churches. To acknowledge that despite some characterisations of it as our best-kept secret, it has a cultural currency within contemporary public policy debates in many countries, which outweighs any other example of Christian social teaching. The English writer Paul Vallely, writing of the aimless drift, as he saw it, of the European left post-1989, proposed Catholic social teaching as the alternative position which alone, he said, possessed the comprehensiveness necessary to fund a critique of capitalism. Staying with economic themes, a key example is the 2009 encyclical Caritas in Veritate, which is unsurpassed in recent theology as a powerful and stable performance of the narrative embedding of the economic within the social, and of the social within a theological vision of the divine economy. I was a member of the Church of Scotland's Commission on the Purposes of Economic Activity, established in the aftermath of the international financial crisis of 2008. And in its focus on the ends of economic activity, the Commission showed its debt to this long-term sightline of Thomistic theology. It was given a nice articulation during the Commission hearings by the theologian Chris Wigglesworth when he said, "The economy is for God, which means it is also for my neighbour, and it is for my neighbour, which means it is also for God." If the strength of Catholic social teaching lies in its capacity for displaying key principles within a grand narrative, it has been suggested again in relation to the post-2008 situation that its weaknesses may lie in the breadth and the openness of the orientation it gives, and its reluctance to wrestle with more detailed social policy implications. Those were criticisms made by Professor Linda Woodhead in an article on the Tablet. So I want to move on with that to my second example. I want to suggest that the particular charism of the Reformed tradition is to be found in its understandings of stewardship, vocation, and discipline. In my own tradition of Scottish Presbyterianism, the word discipline has deep resonances. The manifestos of the first and second generations of the Reformation in Scotland were known as the first and second books of discipline, with John Knox and Andrew Melville as their lead authors. And it's this sense of discipline which is powerfully expounded by Charles Taylor in his 2007 book, A Secular Age, in which he speaks of the rise of the disciplinary society. Taylor tells a story in which the influences of nominalism, neo-stoicism, and Calvinism are brought together in a moment of cultural bravura, fueling an extraordinary self-confidence about the capacity to remodel society. In Taylor's account, this is held together with a key theme from his earlier work in Sources of the Self, that the Reformation dramatically revised understandings of vocation away from the specialized callings of the religious orders towards what he calls, in a lovely phrase, the affirmation of ordinary life. This account of Reformed social vision is not without its own internal tensions. Calvinist theology has been conspicuously aware of both total depravity and human finitude, conscious, therefore, that human beings will often make wrong, selfish, and antisocial choices. Given this, it's notable that Taylor recognized this tradition as having generated such zeal and confidence about the project of reforming European societies in the early modern period. In Scotland, this vision first animated and then was challenged by the reforming visions of the 18th century Scottish Enlightenment, and reasserted itself in the early 19th century in Thomas Chalmers's vision of the godly commonwealth. Its understanding of stewardship was radicalized in Adam Smith's account of economic life, and then widely debased in the context of British imperial expansion, which saw large numbers of Scots Presbyterians on the make, not least here in New Zealand. Such examples of basic Calvinist beliefs biting back illustrate the way in which a reformed social vision takes shape in the face of demanding tensions between aspiration and limitation. The literature of every Calvinist country, well like that of Scotland, abound in testimonies to the personal hypocrisies and indisciplines of those who would reform and discipline others. And without gainsaying those, such counter-testimony does not mean there were no positive social effects of Calvinism in these countries. In the area of economic life, a confidence about social discipline over the Scottish financial sector still had a residual currency and cultural visibility, even, I would say, into the 21st century. It finally died in 2009 with the effective bankruptcy of both the Bank of Scotland and the Royal Bank of Scotland. If the 16th and 17th century versions of this disciplinary dream suffered from Calvinist hubris, the late 20th and early 21st century retreat from regulation evidenced a disciplinary deficit. the acids of right-wing scorn and the canker of left-wing ineptitude combine to eat away at public confidence in the need for effective regulation and in the capacity of the state to provide this. Today, as Western economies struggle to re-regulate and re-stimulate their economies, the need to discover the reformed charism of discipline is pressing once again. In keeping with a reformed alertness to both total depravity and human finitude, a new attention to regulation must be shaped by a double awareness of the ethical deficits which create the need for regulation and the hermeneutical deficits which lead to bad regulation. Recalling Taylor's renaming of reformed vocation as the affirmation of ordinary life, we need to reaffirm the strategic spiritual vocation of the accountant, the regulator, the financial controller. It was interesting, as an aside, that at the time we were setting up the commission in the Church of Scotland, we realised that the chair of one of the leading regulatory bodies for accountancy firms in the UK was a Kirk Elder on a session in Dunbar. But how often was the church in conversation with him? How often did he hear preaching from the pulpit which addressed his day-to-day life or affirmed his ordinary life or perhaps challenged it? Bringing together this and the previous tradition I mentioned, we could say that bankers need tellers, but they also need auditors, those authorised to listen attentively to accounts of our corporate behaviour. The good society needs both a narrative framing which embeds the market within a vision of social relations and a disciplinary vigilance which responds to the ever-present failures of both understanding and virtue. My third ecclesial example comes from the traditions of the Radical Reformation. For a long time, neglected and marginalised in mainstream Protestant ethics, but today, an extremely influential strand taken seriously across the ecumenical spectrum. And we could speak of a number of charisms associated with this tradition, but the one I have in mind here is the characteristic Anabaptist stress on the witness of distinctive and exemplary corporate practice. Here, the reformed sense of the need to restrain evil across society as a whole is balanced by a new stress on the capacity of the Christian community to generate virtuous examples. The drive on the part of Catholic social teaching and Reformed theology to discipline the whole of society is eschewed in favour of an ecclesial ethic which first of all calls the church to be the church. Instead of emphasising discipline as a whole society goal, the stress is placed on the corporate self-discipline of smaller groups of Christians. In economic terms, this can enable them to generate mutual and cooperative models which restrain the profit motive, which offset the drive for personal enrichment, and which reduce the degree of inequality resulting from how an enterprise operates. In his mini-classic Body Politics, John Howard Yoder argued for a pattern of human sociality in which the church prefigures the world. The pattern we shall discover, he says, is that the will of God for human socialness as a whole is prefigured by the shape to which the body of Christ is called. Church and world are not two compartments under separate legislation or two institutions with contradictory assignments, but two levels of pertinence of the same lordship. The people of God is called to be today what the world is called to be ultimately. One of the five key practices Yoder explores in the book is that of disciples breaking bread together. Having highlighted the significance of sharing bread in the Eucharist as an economic act, he speaks of a mediation or bridging over from ecclesial practices to social structures. This kind of mediation, he says, is not a mental or verbal operation of translation or conceptual bridging, but rather the concrete historical presence among their neighbours of believers who, for Jesus' sake, do ordinary social things differently. There may be some relevance to Augustine and what you're working on there, Jono, as well. The influences of this tradition has been illustrated and extended in the work of Texan theologian Stanley Harvass, most famously in his 1983 book, The Peaceable Kingdom, where he argues that the nature and form of the church is the centre of any attempt to develop Christian ethics, and that the church does not have a social ethic, but is a social ethic. Harvath's championing of the work of John Howard Yoder was a key trigger for James Gustafson's infamous paper on the sectarian temptation. This much-cited article, which appeared in 1985, argued that Harvath was engaged in retreat from responsible Christian concern for society into an idealized ecclesial location where purity came at the expense of relevance. A phrase you could perhaps use about the Corbyn Labour Party in the UK at the moment. A further major critique of Harvath and Yoder was launched by Geoffrey Stout in his 2004 Democracy and Tradition, where Stout registered his concern at the growing influence of their work within North American theology. However, despite these significant theological disagreements, and also because of them, interest in and appreciation of Anabaptist theology continues to grow across many Christian traditions. In a world where Christianity is so often co-opted or compromised, the charism of difference has a particular attraction. To live it out authentically surely is not just a sectarian device to keep your hands clean, but a different and often costly way of getting your hands dirty. And those of us from traditions which have often succumbed to the Constantinian or the Erastian temptation have things to learn from those who have not. In conclusion, then, I have traced the outline of what we might call an ecumenical vision of the good society. I've suggested that the traditions of Catholic social teaching offer a narrative account of the ends and goals of society, whilst Reformed political theology furnishes a broad understanding of vocation and stewardship and the dynamic stress on enacting discipline and regulation. Anabaptist traditions stress the importance of witness and a communitarian drive to generate virtuous examples which can act as models for a good society. Within the landscape of contemporary theology, these traditions are keenly aware of one another and are increasingly influencing and inflecting one another. My aim here is to support and encourage that ecumenical synergy, recognizing that while there are many critical debates still to be had, each of these traditions brings something essential to the table. In particular, reflecting on my own location as someone whose thinking has been enriched by my encounters with Catholic social teaching and Anabaptist theology, I want to recommend the contribution of the Reformed tradition, which is, I think, currently less valued and valorized in political theology than the other two. My thinking about the importance of a Reformed stress on discipline was stirred by reflection on the post-2008 economic crisis, in which failures of regulation relating to banks and financial markets were such a key factor. Public or political theology has many urgent challenges before it today in relation to migration, to war, to climate change, and it needs to rise to these, but it also needs to strengthen its engagement with economic themes. To do this most effectively, it needs to work with a keen ecumenical awareness, drawing on the charisms God has given to the churches. These three remain: narrative, discipline, and witness. And we need them all. Thank you very much.